Without Mr. Cross in his office, we wouldn't be able to have any guests in. Starting next week, we're going to be having guests in from out of town. We haven't had any from out of town yet, really in specialized work. So, Jim, I want to thank you for doing this for us. We're looking forward not only to your own presentation, but for the rest of the course. But
well, as I would say, it's a little old age, and 10 years and a little hard to grasp it, they're being the course.
Well, we applaud them.
Yeah, do you use the dialogic style, Carl?
However you want. You can
delight your memory so far from me.
Doesn't matter to us, whatever.
Well, maybe I could just spend, fellas, a few sentences on the historical background for this. Special ministries have been with the Senate as long as the Senate has existed. The first field that was endeavored and attempted by the Senate was back in the 1870s with the initiation of Indian ministry in the Frankenwood area. It died a horrible death. The second attempt, and a very relevant creative one, it was one that was initiated by Walter himself in the 1880s when there was an immigration to the country. Began increasing very rapidly, and also the number of shipments of goods from overseas countries to the USA was increasing very rapidly. And so there were a great many Scandinavian and German sailors in the East Coast ports. And Dr. Walter felt the necessity of calling a synodical missionary at large in order to relate to both the immigrant population and the seamen's ministry population. He cast around the church to find if anyone had the gifts requisite for the job and discovered that there wasn't anybody. But he, through his research, discovered a converted Jewish rabbi who had recently become a pastor in the Episcopalian church, gave him an hour and a half doctoral interview, and for the next 22 years, this man served as an Episcopalian priest, as a synodical missionary at large for seamen's and immigrant ministries. So yes, Virginia, Dr. Walter is a swinger.
Has any of this ever been written up?
Yes, it has. Yeah. Yeah, Augie did some real good research for us when he belatedly renewed Siemens ministry just 2 years ago. Synod really began, I think, to take, and these are comparative terms, I know you'll understand that, diverse people seriously, at least insofar as synodical conventions are concerned, beginning with the San Francisco Convention. It does come out of San Francisco occasionally. There were resolutions that were passed at that convention, were refined at Cleveland, probably had their fullest expression in Detroit in conjunction with the mission affirmations. But supposed to be the role of the church in reaching and serving and ministering to people in the full spectrum of ministry, other than middle class, Anglo-Saxons, and particularly Germans. These memorials were fantastically specific, and as often as I have been forced to go back to them to justify our involvement in certain kinds of ministries, I'm amazed at the degree to which these men were prophetic. And their explicit whereases and explicit resolves on the subject of political action, of social action, of radical action, even the word radical is used explicitly, that is not necessarily correlated with a word in sacrament, a tandem resolution. These found their expression in the structure of the church, finally in about 1962, when Pastor Reuben Schmidt, who is today my boss, was called as the Assistant Executive Secretary of Mission Intensification. And by intensification was meant the ferreting out of disparate groups that had been historically overlooked, and the initiation of mission and ministry to and among them. This proceeded very well under the administration of Pastor Schmidt under the old Board of North and South American Missions. This was during the era in which Synod had no less than 8 different mission boards. An overseas or foreign mission board, a home missions board, which really included North and South America, blind, deaf, campus, several other particular facets. But when the Board for Missions was consolidated and united as a result of convention action in 65, all these eight boards were merged. Pastor Schmidt then became the director of special services for the Board for Missions, and there were a number of offices that were either attached to his leadership or were newly created within the spectrum of special services. And these include blind, deaf, campus, evangelism, church extension, and the office that I privileged to hold, what is called Church and Community Ministries. This kind of presents a little bit of a historic frame. The first time that the board, either the predecessor board or the present board, had any bread to work with in terms of acting out the resolutions that had been passed was in 1962, when Senate passed a resolution granting the Board for Missions $100,000 for experimental purposes, chiefly in urban areas, but other kinds of needs were identified, such as Indian reservations, town and country, neglected areas, and the like. And Synod was authorized to augment its normal subsidy to subsidize districts, or even, where necessary, to fund experimentally new ministry attempts in the so-called self-supporting districts. The deluge, you wouldn't believe, of applications from the field in response to that $100,000. It would have meant about 50 cents per pilot project if we had responded literally to all of these. And I'm sure that you can appreciate why. This was right towards the peak of the era of Lutheran escape from the inner city in the core city. You know, in Chicago, in a decade, we had seen 45 Missouri Synod congregations leave the core city. And proportionally, the same thing was happening in New York, Dallas, Houston, you name it, in terms of major urban areas, this was happening. So, first of all, there was the real problem in giving priority, well, in sorting out what constituted not only the best ministry opportunities, but also the best learning opportunities, because it was hoped that the experimentation could provide insights and models for ministry that would be applicable elsewhere. And there had to be a very painful kind of judgment made. This is so far gone that the potentials for its revival, for its renewal, aren't too great. Probably that was the most painful process in which staff had ever engaged. Initially, also, the style was that the Synodical Board for Missions directly funded congregational or New Frontiers ministries on the firing line. The district was involved only in a consultative capacity. The action really came from the national level to the local level. But as time has gone on since that point, we increasingly felt that the same policy that we exercise normally vis-a-vis districts from a mission perspective ought to be the polity that we exercise also when it comes to exploratory and experimental ministries. And that is to say that we are committed to a philosophy of decentralized administration, that districts are closer to the action, that they know to a greater extent than we ever can the peculiar factors and forces in which they and their people are caught up. And so that even in special ministries today, as it has been historically in normative new mission starts, the practice is that the districts, in dialogue with local people, determine the need for renewal of ministry, augmentation of ministry, intensification of ministry, establishment of new ministries. And then we act in an undergirding relationship to the districts and in team with them in a consultative relationship to the field. I'm pleased to say that much of this has become self-generating during the course of the last 3 years. That is to say that no longer is the Synod in the seeding function by itself. That is, districts develop more and more of the table of experience and of understanding of the potentials for mission and ministry in radically different cultures. They themselves are, you know, taking increasing initiative. And that's borne out by the fact that the projections for the Synod from the districts for the next triennium indicate that there will be at least as many new starts, and I think this has tremendous implications for the seminary, at least as many new starts in detached or non-congregationally based ministries as there will be in conventional new mission starts. In other words, over 50% of the future, the new action, will be in special ministries as opposed to conventional new mission beginnings. Well, that's just a bit of the history and also somewhat of an indication of the process. A representative example, I'm sorry to bore so many students that I've had in past classes, would be the one that occurred in Jacksonville a couple of years ago. Suddenly, after a long time period of fruitless negotiation, Dr. Gockel was able to get the local TV outlet in Jacksonville to start showing This Is the Life. And it so often happens when the program is shown in a new community, this triggers literally hundreds and thousands of letters from people, not only with respect to so-called spiritual problems, but marital conflicts, unwed parenthood, housing, all the rest. And I've never seen a man as faithful in responding meaningfully, specifically, to each letter that comes, and also following through in a very beautiful way with people in terms of referring and making a meaningful connection between a local Lutheran clergy and the person who has written. Well, the pastors down there followed through real fine and provided whatever ministry was necessary, but they began to ponder the implications over and above the specific request to which they were responding. It meant something to them that almost all the requests were coming from a very concentrated area of the city. Jacksonville is proportionally the largest ghetto of any urban area in the United States. And our church classically has congregations all around the outer ring of the metropolitan area, but not in the heart of the city. And so they began asking themselves the questions, you know, what in the world is the Lord trying to say to us? Well, instead of going off into a Winkle conference and trying to find out the answer to that, they said, let's go to our congregations. And within short order, there were 120 people, or 10% of all the communicants in Jacksonville, that were involved in a study process, study both of the affirmations and their specificity as one would apply it to their urban environment, a study of community, which not only involved a, you know, a sterile academic exercise of talking to experts about people, here's my bias is showing through, but also involved reflection of sorts. And after 6 months, this dialogue produced a beautiful statement of theology of mission and ministry to their metropolitan area, and also a 16-point strategy for ministry in the metropolitan area. Well, the district had had no prior table of experience in anything other than new mission starts. And I don't fault them for this, because we all know the fantastic rise in population in Florida and demands this place is on, you know, conventional new parishes. So when it hit the district mission board, they requested Pastor Schmidt and I come down and walk this through with them. And we did, and we joined a team of district staff and walked the same ground in an abbreviated way that the local people of God had done, and concurred wholeheartedly in their conclusions. The district then asked us to be in a continuing relationship with both them and with what later became known as Lutheran City Center, this caucus of Lutheran Christians, cut across congregational lines. We had a sustained relationship with this one, because the district felt that by walking this one through with us, it would amount to a kind of teaching content for their generic involvement in special ministries. And so this is the kind of thing that often triggers our field involvement. And we are involved now that Jacksonville ministry has been well shaped and is being miraculously fulfilled. We're involved in a continuing relationship of participating in the evaluations with district people that take place periodically, again for the purposes of helping, giving field consultative counsel, but also so that out of our continued liaison with these exciting things that are happening out in the field, we are able to communicate the learning you see elsewhere in the church. Maybe I could stop at this point. I can see I'm getting long-winded again. And maybe, instead of talking formally from this point on, why don't the questions come, if this is agreeable?
50%?
Yes. Right.
Sir, I understand there aren't too many new mission starts, though. Anyhow.
True.
That number's way down.
Yes, right. It used to average during the mid-50s to 1960, about 135 a year. Number's down to about 50 currently. I think that those figures in themselves go to be misleading, because in the late 50s and very early 60s, the church was on a kick of almost starting missions for their own sake, and it's lived to regret this very seriously. There are 10 new starts that were made in Nevada in the mid-50s, and the largest congregation is 50 communicants today. And in other words, there was a quota, a carrot, that was before every district. You are not being faithful to your Lord and Savior Jesus Christ, God bless. And if you want to buy a $200,000 white elephant in Boulder, South Dakota, for 5 cents on the dollar, I know of a certain district that would be very pleased to deal with you. I'm not being facetious, but I don't think that the numbers represent necessarily a change in priority, but a much more realistic approach. But it is true that the ratio of kinds of starts has changed very significantly.
I know when I was a member of the Atlantic District, we had a quota. The number was three. Now, whether it was three a month, that sounded pretty high. But I remember that we had our quota. It didn't really matter where they were started. Let's start.
Well, I think that the change, gentlemen, in new mission starts, if you don't mind this tangent for a moment, is not only a consequence of this negative kind of learning that I spoke about before, or necessarily a matter of fiscal consideration. I'm sorry to bore some of the class members, but maybe I could indicate the kind of rationale that is increasingly in our church. It involves quite an element of risk, and yet I think if we're really concerned about the church being the Christ mission of the whole church, really concerned about the total well-being of this body, really concerned about what the proliferation, if not an excess, of congregational units in a small place represents negatively by way of witness to the community, that increasingly this kind of style of mission planning is going to have to take hold. In the South Dakota Reservation, in the Navajo Reservation, which encompasses portions of four states, Utah, Colorado, New Mexico, and Arizona, the Indians had a rather exceptional polity. The Indians, the Navajos, were never conquered militarily by the U.S. cavalry. They were about the only tribe that wasn't. And though the churches have been established historically on the reservation, they have never been allowed to purchase property. It's simply leases that are offered to churches. Navajo practice is this. If a new church wants to get on the reservation, it must first get the signatures by petition of a majority of the residents of that reservation. Then the petition goes to the tribal council, which has a formula by which it decides this is the proper ratio between church units and Christian. Then they grant a lease for 3 years, provided that the church fits within that quota. And they ask for a copy of the church's constitution, bylaws, and statement of objectives. At the end of 3 years, they evaluate the church's performance in the light of its own expressed objectives. In the light of the church's own expressed objectives. And they go about this very objectively. And most churches have been off the reservation at the end of 3 years because of their unfaithfulness to their own expressed purposes. I wonder how many of our congregations could stand that kind of review. Well, at any rate, there is for the first time since 1962 an urban community on the reservation. fairly sparsely set in the country, less than one family per square mile on the reservation. But the Navajos, thanks to as faithful and competent and sophisticated planning processes I've ever seen in any context, urban or rural, are beginning to develop in an intelligent way the vast natural resources on the reservation. They have one third of the reservation in virgin timber. Virgin timber in the USA is as rare as virgin. And they have developed a community
that was on tour,
which carries with it the same kind of people themselves, Navajo. A planned community which will probably level off in population at about 10,000 by 1970. It has two foci. One, the harvesting of the timber. Number two, the construct of low-cost prefab housing to service housing for the people of the reservation. Well, there is a group known as the Fellowship of Christian Navajo Workers. This is a dialogic group that encompasses all of the denominations that are represented on the reservation, exclusive of Mormon, exclusive of RC. No, it's inclusive of RC, but there's one other Pentecostal group that isn't a part. But this has existed for some 30 years, and this has not simply been a political organization attempting to break down these tribal barriers. Most churches are very uncomfortable in living under this kind of a scrutiny of their faithfulness to their own purposes. But rather, it's been a group that has been very concerned about doctrine and practice. And as a consequence of this dialogue that's gone on for a generation and a half, they have achieved locally a far greater degree of unanimity and harmony about the essential character of the gospel, about word, about sacrament, all of this, and would be true of these same groups on a national level. We're able to put it in our historic phrases. Their agreement on primary fundamental doctrines is called complete. Well, at any rate, in terms of the formula of the Navajo tribe, this town, when it reaches its population of 10,000, should accommodate at the most four Christian congregations. And on the matter, and this through this council, by drawing lots, as well as by a very frank determination, we have the resources to move in or we don't. The Presbyterians, the Baptists, Catholics, and the Episcopalians receive the options to begin operations here. The Presbyterians found that they did not have the expected resources to initiate the ministry in this city. And so this opportunity became available to the Lutherans. Incidentally, the question of fellowship seems a little bit passe out there because they have had an ALC-Missouri Synod Indian Ministry Fellowship, which is funded by both districts and by the congregations of the area for 35 years. That's an aside. But at any rate, the Lutherans got the option here. Well, keeping in mind the character of the Christian consensus on the reservation, as I illustrated through this fellowship of Christian Navajo workers, keeping in mind this, which wouldn't always be a reality elsewhere, the Lutherans felt that rather than starting a conventional, self-contained parish, or at least starting out with this as a working assumption, that they would better try to foresee the functioning of Christ's mission in these three other parishes. First, what was the quality of the gospel that was being spoken here? What understanding of the sacraments was being interpreted by the pastors who served these places? What gaps in ministry were reflected here? To what extent could there be some kind of de forma, of de facto or de jure team relationship here? And the understanding that they reached, at least tentatively, was that the quality of the word being proclaimed from the pulpit and the right understanding of the sacraments was essentially already built in. And that rather than a the establishment of a competitive mission enterprise, taking very realistically the fact that only 5% of the Indians who become members of a new congregation anywhere in the USA were previously without Christ. It's simply a matter of musical chairs. And I think that's pretty true in American culture generally, as a matter of fact. Well, because of this general Christian navigable consensus, because of the oneness, basically, in terms of word and sacrament, the Lutherans felt rather than a conventional new mission start, for the sake of Christ's mission in this place, it's better that we instead attempt to respond to some of the deficiencies in the total ministry, witness, service, and the rest. And so they are focusing, are focusing on adult Christian education, on family counseling. These are the two primary areas, and certain other related factors. So we'll be in support of the total Christian expression here. Now certainly if the Christian unity that's manifest here, and not on a Johnson type of consensus basis, should in some way deteriorate, Lutherans would certainly be free to reassess their ministry and permit it to assume another form. All I'm trying to say, gentlemen, through this example is that no longer are we saying, here is a town of 25,000. There is no Lutheran parish in this town. Therefore, we must start a parish. But rather, and this is very difficult to fulfill and achieve, what is the quality of the gospel in this place? And then making a judgment as to whether, what can we do to strengthen it if basically it's correct, and if it is weak and irredeemable, then we think of parish. But we don't think of parish first, then ministry. They're in the reverse order, with parish being but one of the options available. I'm sorry, that's kind of tangential. It isn't in special ministries as such, and yet I think it does represent a somewhat different approach than the one which we've exercised historically. Yeah.
You've already sort of touched on this, but to what extent are you currently working together with the ALC and the LCA in making your plans and programs in the area of specialized ministry?
Well, I would say this, that I'll answer the prior question if I may. The planning, the joint planning, in terms of new mission beginnings, is complete through LACUSA. There are very well developed procedures. The practice has been excellent. The only fly in the ointment, so to speak, has been that in the ALC and in the LCA, the districts or synods, the jurisdictional units of the church, have authority not only over the subsidized parishes, as even we do in a sense, but also over self-supporting parishes. In other words, in the ALC and the LCA, an established self-supporting congregation cannot relocate or close without the sanction of the executive committee. We don't have that kind of authority in Missouri, so the one sore point, you see, in mission planning is that when a new mission is envisioned, let's say by LCA, and they make the prescribed announcement a year ahead, we would like to start over here, and the other groups respect that. Well, in Missouri, suddenly a self-supporting parish may decide it likes to move over there. And there's really no way outside of the Council of Brethren that can be used to prevent a competitive situation from arising. But on the whole, it's working very, very well. Now, when it comes to special ministries, I think that there is a similar high degree of cooperation, but it assumes different forms in different places. I could use an illustration too. In San Francisco, for example, you'll be having Will Hertzfeld later in the course. Their will is concentrating on the black situation. He is the Lutheran urban minister, technically simply the urban minister of our Calabata district, but practically speaking, on behalf of all three bodies. The Greater Bay Area. Joe Bart, I wish we could do 42 minutes in the West Coast. Joe Bart is focusing on white racism. This is the one successful model of white racism in the whole Christian church. That's not an exaggeration. He is the LCA. He is their urban minister for dealing with white racism. And so each one is doing a complementary part of the job. This is one style. You follow? And there's certainly maximum confrontation between the two men and between the two boards to which they're responsible. So you have a kind of parallelism that's true in some places. In several places, one also sees a different kind of style whereby there's actually a joint auspice. What is arising in Rochester, New York, for example, where Lutherans are taking responsibility in consultation with FIGHT and with other black power organizations for a ministry of word, sacrament, service, and social action in a given sector of that city. The worker who is in the process of being called will be responsible to the local chapter of LHRAA, which in itself, you see, is an inter-Lutheran chapter, an inter-Lutheran group. I would say this is probably the more common style. Only in a few places is any Lutheran group going in alone. And these few places are situations in which either the other group is, they're probably conceptually ready, but the breadth isn't there, or they're not represented that significantly in terms of numbers. For instance, in Montana, a new Indian ministry is arising. 90% of all Lutherans in Montana are ALC, 5% Missouri, 2% Church of the Confession, and some other groups. Missouri just doesn't have the resources in that state, you see. But the ALC will be doing that ministry really on behalf of all, and there would be illustrations from the other side. In addition to this, there are, of course, the ecumenical involvements that we do have in some places. It's interesting, but we are, for the most part, the only Lutheran body involved in ecumenical special ministries. That's curious, but it's true. And I think it's mainly due to the fact that there are so many problems of working through the very complex structure of the two other Lutheran bodies. There isn't really the freedom of movement to relate to something that you would like to relate to. The procedures are immense. A good illustration is MAP, Metropolitan Associates of Philly. You can be having Paul Geddington later. This is an ecumenical team ministry for equipping laity for ministry through the structures and vocations which they're significantly involved in that major metropolitan area. The LCA asked us in when they had the invitation 4 years ago because they didn't want to be the only confessional church along with Episcopalian, Presbyterian, and not the Church of Christ. We came in, 4 years later they're still trying to get in. But their own internal requirements, you know, you don't blow your nose without a call to, seriously. I mean, if you had deliberately, intended to write a constitution that wasn't workable, you couldn't have done better. And actually, as old and creaky as our constitution seems to many of us, including me, it actually gives us more freedom of movement than almost any other body in the USA. That sounds crazy, but it's true. But in general, the cooperation is fine, and it's either a matter of sharing respective specializations or something that's actually coordinated.
A couple of questions I have. One, your position seems to me a position that a lot of people could get very angry in, and I wonder if you get angry, and to what extent, and do you think anger is justified in this position? And secondly, I was wondering, what is, and you can take this question anyway, you want to, what is your approach to the black situation at the present time? Do you have any rationale worked out where you think it is right now? What kind of approach, or is it just too fragmented to have any sort of one single approach that we as white folks? I mean, this is a very personal kind of question. Where you are on it. And this just kind of plays in with this whole anger, this is how angry should we become our...
Well, I think there are phases. For me personally, to speak to your prior question first, but involve frustration. So sometimes anger, and occasionally that anger is justified. Certainly, chronically, deep feelings of inadequacy, and I don't think those should be discounted, and those are wholly realistic, believe me. Because of the immense problem of communicating to people who's in our church, the problem is never communication with the world itself, it's internal, whose life experiences don't in any way, shape, or form touch what's happening on the cutting edge. And I think that not only is the problem one for me, but it is also a problem, particularly for those who are in cutting edge ministry. Fellow in Siemens ministry, a fellow in next year's racetrack ministry, people in the ghetto areas, people in Indian ministry, you name it. People especially in my context. The frustration, you know, nobody else understands me. And often this is true, or it's true in degree, but oftentimes becomes a kind of self-fulfilling prophecy. I really don't want to share. I really don't see my function as being in any way, shape, or form equipping the rest of the body of Christ so that they too, in some way, can relate to what concerns me so deeply. So you've got this problem on the one side, and you have the problem of those who don't care to grow, don't care to know, want to apply historic answers to solutions which no longer apply to the same historic context. And so I think one of the greatest problems for me personally is helping others work through precisely the same crisis that I have never been completely able to work through. That's very real. That could be blitz there. But that's a great crisis we're having right now with the board of directors, as you said. Stand by a great deal from the field. They say a great deal, probably, you know, through the little package, I don't know. But they're getting a great deal of heat, they feel, with regard to reference to EBCOR, East Bay Conference on Religion and Race, which is really the primary arena for Will's ministry. This is a coalition primarily of church groups in the Bay Area, which is trying to serve as a temporal instrument of reconciliation between the wild scene that's out there, Panthers versus police, Berkeley students versus Berkeley police. Berkeley School Board, which is with it, versus Berkeley. Well, you know something like that. Really, if this organization didn't exist, what's happened in Berkeley would be like a Sunday school picnic compared to what really would occur there. Now, some critics, and I'm not being judgmental of these, because unless I was in some way related to it, I probably too would question it, are saying, in the first place, the church should not be involved in any kind of temporal healing, brokerage role at all. There are those that might buy this, but feel that any ministry that in any way relates to a group, which is, from my perspective, essentially rather conservative than Catholics, that any group that relates to a group such as this is contaminated thereby in the process. Other groups say that it's all right for you to be involved in this kind of a ministry, but for heaven's sake, don't call it mission. Call it social ministry and you'll accept it, but don't call it mission. So there's this kind of view. And finally, there's the kind of view that says, obviously all you're doing in the greater Bay Area is temporal ministry, period, which isn't the case at all, because the insights that are flowing out of involvement in EBCOR are immediately utilized by the district, not only by Will, in terms of informing them as to how in the world this wouldn't speak the gospel in situations. But communication is real difficult, very difficult. And one effort they were going to make, believe me, sometimes you get so caught up in the action that you don't take seriously or don't take the time to deal with matters of communication. But beginning with the April issue of Advance magazine, and continuing over a pilot period of 3 years, we will be publishing 4 case studies each every other issue, or roughly 24 a year, that will pick up each pilot area, whether it's one to which we've been related or a district, speak to what its what was the original seed idea that led to its articulation? How was it refined? What has been learned positively and negatively? Who are some resource people that are interested in deep working for information can provide some input? It's not primarily going to be an instrument of justification. I would care less about it if it were to be this, but rather it's going to be hopefully something that will not provide recipes or stencils for ministry, but stimuli. You know, maybe here's an idea that we should reckon with seriously, but take seriously our own culture into account before we just blindly adopt it or adapt it. That's a real problem. Not a black situation. Thanks to the Lord, and I mean that literally, I think that the Lutheran Church as a whole will probably come through the readjustment to the new black situation better than most other church groups. Mainly because the black brethren refused to give up on us as brethren. I know no other way to put it. I certainly have had like relationships, like from my standpoint, maybe dead from theirs, with our black clergy over the last 3-4 years since I started out on this job. But I suppose my baptism, in a sense, occurred about a year and a half ago, it seems like an eternity now, when one of us from each of the bodies was asked to come to New York and stand by in the event that a coalition of black Lutheran churchmen wanted to talk to us, so we sat in the corridor for 2 days in a room that we could hear screaming and yelling and some physical interchange. And I'm not being sarcastic, these men had to establish an identity of their own. It came to great pain to themselves. And at that point we were asked in, and this was when we were told that there would be this first black caucus, which took place in June. Was it this last June? Mm-hmm. Gee, when was this last June? Sorry, that's an old man reflecting. Yeah. And, of course, there is since been the second caucus here in St. Louis, and everyone's projected out the spring. I probably don't need to go into the shape of Association of Black Women Church from here, or maybe, I don't know how many of you are familiar with it. All things considered, I think, number one, these men, while not ruling out the extremist, quote, solution, end quote, withdrawal from the Lutheran Church, are really putting their bread and their lives and their commitment on the line in terms of, you know, redeeming this Lutheran Church. And thank God, the openness that's no great change, it should have happened historically a long time ago, but the openness and the seriousness with which various people and structures in the church are taking their recommendations is affirming that style that they have embarked on. I'm sharing with some members of the class last night, two things that may seem minor, and yet I thought they were tremendously significant. If any of you have ever considered, you know, going the way of colloquy instead of graduating from the SEM, you probably, you know, withdrawn that alternative thought if you've ever looked at the handbook, because it's much easier, really, to go through the seminary than to be colorized, unless you're a transfer from some other sin, or an established transfer from other seminary. But a very gifted young black that I've known for some time, is a member of Will Griffin's Parish in Chicago, wrote to the college committee, high school graduate, no formal training beyond this time, although he's self-taught to a pretty refined degree in both theology and community organization. He wrote to the college committee, and Wieder Anders is the chairman of that committee. And Wieder Anders, who really went through baptism complete at that first Chicago caucus, you know, came in talking Uncle Tom and came out talking black, and who jumped the agenda for two subsequent board of directors meetings of the Senate. There will be no other business. And had the black leadership do essentially what they did in Chicago for the board of directors. And as was said patently, our church has been and continues to be a religious institution. And meaning it isn't simply a play for black folks. In consultation with Hopple, and this man is on salary. That's again my work this year for 3 years. The Collective Committee has worked out a special 3-year program in involve three sources of equipment for this major. One is Black Brother, number two, RM, number three, Naval School of Theology. The Synod has pre-committed itself, even though its regulations stand clearly to the contrary, that if all things go well, this man will be ordained in 3 years. That's one reassigned hope to me. The second relates to the Black Diaconate Program. Some of you may be familiar with the model that was developed in Chicago by Bill Drennan and five other Black pastors. This model had the intent of serving a useful purpose in terms of, well, maybe I could get at it this way better. We all know how few Black clergymen there are in our church body. Grand total in all three Lutheran churches combined of 87. The grand total of two in any of the seminaries, total of the Lutheran church. That if we're ever going to get the production of Black clergy in balance with demand, it will take us probably a couple of decades. Which means that we're going to be in for some new days. Second factor is that all of our clergy deal with Black clergy, but none of them can be spared on the firing line when the service so tense in the cities. And related to that, that were they to leave and accept explicit synodical posts, there would be an immediate credibility gap. They would be considered as Uncle Tom's family of Blacks, not necessarily Black Christians, but Blacks from the non. So that in order to take those factors into account seriously, they would say what we need is a number of auxiliary ministers who can pretty largely, or at least be of service to us in taking care of the parish functions that we are presently dealing with, therefore leaving us free to be in consultative ministry in the field. See, I haven't gone any place in the last 2.5 years to a church which is either Black or will be Black within the foreseeable future without the co-accompaniment of Black clergy. This hasn't been their requirement, but our conviction that we won't be able to dig this seam unless and until. So the Black Diaconate proposal would take roughly two dozen young Black Lutherans from the several congregations of the greater Chicago area, put them through a crash program at Theology Community Organization, include also a quarter at UTC. And at the end of this time, these men would serve as auxiliary ministers of food, worship, etc., for the parishes. They would also have the advantage that the pastor would still have a foot in the action. And one of the great problems we always have to reckon with in the administration says, no, it's less. You're looking at one of those six there. Well, at any rate, we had a blue ribbon, so-called blue ribbon committee, and the Black pastors developed this diaconate proposal in detail. And Martin Marnie and Kennedy and Dick Lukey and Sue Peabody and Archie Hargrave, a couple of dozen of us were there to, at the Black request, review this, trying to help them refine this model. And I got a letter last week that the Board of Higher Education and the Board of Control, the Rear Forest, informed the Board of Higher Education, did not request the Board of Higher Education. That's an important distinction. That they were going to be in the ministry that sees this program. They are calling a Black curriculum coordinator developer. Essentially, it will be a self-contained program. And the detail of this Black person will require from the existing faculty to make this program operative. I'm pleased, not that you know the picture is completely beautiful, but there has been a fairly faithful institutional response. Now, it can be motivated by self-preservation instincts, but I don't feel it's all that by any means. I'm quite encouraged.
Could I jump in here for a moment?
Yeah.
Prof. Wagner asked me to ask each of our guests to comment on, for the sake of our curriculum commission, to comment on seminary curriculum. And you touched on it when you spoke of the Black Diaconate and on the crash program for ordaining Black pastors. If it is true that 50%, roughly 40-60, of future new openings will be in the area of specialized, that is, non-parish, at least, ministries. If that is premise number one. Premise number two, which might be weak or not, and that is that most of our young graduates go into new types of situations. It has been the parish, but they may be slotted for experimental ministries. At least younger men usually are. So within 5 years of their graduation, they may be in a unique situation. Given these two premises, what do you see in the seminary's curriculum? What changes do you think have been made in the seminary's curriculum to better prepare them for this kind of ministry? What strengths are there in the curriculum now which ought to be exploited?
Well, I would say that I feel, I probably share the same feelings as Dick Luthi. And that is, contrary to what I have said thus far might suggest, I feel the essential task of the seminary is not to produce ministers for given specialization, but prepare generic ministers alive to the potential of mission and ministry in any situation in which they would be called. If it does this task of enabling people to see potentials wherever they go, I think it will have done its job. Then I think there are the postgraduate functions of urban training center, clinical pastoral education, language and cultural studies, a host of other things. But I think that the thing that the church needs more desperately than anything else is men who are generalists. Church is usually always about two decades behind the secular world in terms of its perceptions of what society needs. Medicine has already discarded, or has begun to question at least, its overemphasis on specialization. Most major corporations have gotten over the centralization phase, and you've seen all more and more of them adopting the General Motors model of quasi-autonomous subsidiaries like Pontiac, Olds, Frigidaire, and so on and so forth. Whereas in Synod, we're getting right at the height of the centralization crisis. And instead of freeing people from ministry, we're freezing them out of ministry. I'm sorry about what I said. But I think that some of what I'm saying is germane to the question you raised, Carol. I feel with all my heart that the place for a fellow with good urban insights in the economy of God may well be town and country. After all, whites do urbanize the economy. Take a state like South Dakota, loses a third of, it will have lost a third of its population in the decade from 60 to 70. Now, should we focus mainly on remedial ministry after people go through the cultural shock, going to an urban area, adjusting to urban church, both of which are radically different than their previous table of life experiences? Or should we have some of the best urban men out there, you see, to equip them in advance of change? Don't we need some of the best town and country men in the city who can pick people up where they are? I think that I have a tremendous respect for the gifts with which God has accented each of us. And yet I think the basic task in an era of polarization is giving a man who, you know, sees the whole of God's mission, carries with it, you know, a total identification with it, even though his one special accent is this or that or the other. So I feel the task of the seminary is complete, thank God for it, as it produces generic ministry. And let the specialization occur, for the most part at least, other than some general exposures after English.
It's very interesting you should say that, because there are some in here say to me, and it's invariably in the first year class, that we would like to pick our specialization upon entering the seminary, think through. Whereas I think, as you said, that more the older men are saying that we should produce certain kinds of men who are able to go into various areas.
Now, I say that, and I know that you are not assuming that I'm saying that. I'm not saying that what is happening at either SEM is what is needed today. I don't happen to feel that in many respects it is. maybe real radical here, but I remember the comment of, you know, there were several self-study committees that were involved in the process last year that involved not only members of the faculty and the student bodies, but also laity and clergy in the greater San Luis area. I happened to be on a committee that was Blue Ribbon, except for myself, and it encompassed Mickey Kretzman and Steve Huey, a very gifted young student, and Bill Danker, and a few other guys, including a layman who has an 8th grade education from Perry County. And we were dreaming great dreams one night, despite the fact that we had nothing stronger than coffee. And this layman says, you know, I've just got to say something, no matter how radical it sounds. I said, well, feel free. And he said, I think one of the greatest factors affecting the morale and the sense of mission on the part of the church is that because of the length of the process of preparing pastors, that we keep men past the point of maximum identification with causes. That it was his feeling that in the late teens, the early 20s, a person sort of reaches his peak in terms of free identification of persons and issues. And he said, we're keeping him 4 or 5 years past that peak. And we said, well, you know, what's your solution? And he says, it'd be my recommendation that we ordain men right out of Fort Wayne and then require that at stated intervals, like every 3rd year afterwards, they come back for perhaps a 6 month period or a quarter, and ultimately maybe in 15 years they get their BD. I think this has to be. So, if I can go back to some of the things I was saying earlier, gentlemen, the role I have is not one of being the expert, the source of counsel to the church on the cutting edge. Nothing could be more ridiculous on the face of it. But my function is the enablement of the mission on the cutting edge, which is a radically different thing. I use this one illustration of the coal ministry of blacks with me to the field that turned out to be a black turf. It means, in general, in this connection, getting expertise to the field as needed, as requested. It means sensitizing districts to potentials for ministry that maybe they haven't reckoned with, or something that our own research has led us to feel that the church has to reckon with in some way. And since we do not directly administer field operations, it means convincing, cajoling, pleading, I can't threaten, some district into undertaking some new dimension of ministry that has hitherto been neglected. It means also that as we can, and as there is need, we attempt some modest financial undergirding for a limited time span. Let's say that District X sees a real opportunity, and we concur in reflection with them that this is a beautiful thing. Well, no district really has the budget flexibility today, you see, to suddenly add in midstream a new ministry during the course of a particular fiscal year. So to give them enough lead time, you follow me, to build it into their ongoing program, we can fund up to 100% of the first year operation of that special ministry, which enables them to build a new basis. So my function is, I think, more than anything else, a matter of helping people to think through. That's just about the length of that. Affirming the freedom that's already there is the gospel. That's just about the side of it. And it's not done. Now, I mentioned that the districts are pretty well in mission in a number of specialized ministry fields. However, because of the increasing importance of non-geographic community, this phenomenon of non-geographic community is far more significant in our culture and certainly will for the future than geographic area. We have begun, just as one way of beginning to explore that dimension, a number of dialogic reflection groups with persons caught up in the non-geographic subculture.